You're listening to Road to GEM, a podcast by Harvard Center for International Development. In 2024, we're unpacking and exploring gender and breaking away from the common notion within the sector that gender only equals women and girls. I'm thrilled to be dedicating three whole episodes to the LGBTQ plus movement worldwide, where we'll zoom into countries like Kenya, Brazil, and Lebanon to hear from activists and organizers who are leading the way. But today, we're zooming out. We're exploring the gaps and opportunities of the movement worldwide. And I'm so excited to be here with Diego Garcia Blum, director of the Global LGBTQI Plus Human Rights Program at the Carr Center for Human Rights at the Harvard Kennedy School, and with Professor Tim McCarthy. Professor McCarthy teaches at the Harvard Kennedy School and at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, and he has been a longtime faculty affiliate with the Carr Center. Most importantly, in my opinion, he's taught me. Welcome both.
Great to see you. Great to be with you in a different context. I loved having you as a student, but I can't wait to be in conversation with you. And of course, Diego, my dear colleague and friend.
Definitely.
You too. Well, today, since we're zooming out and analyzing worldwide trends, I wanted to start with you, Professor McCarthy, as a historian of social movements. I'm very curious to hear your view on the moment. What does it look like from your perspective? How would you describe the current state of the LGBTQ movement worldwide?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a very hard one to answer because I think that we are living in a moment that has lots of forces that are operating, both good and bad, that are truly global. But I also think it's important for us to put things in their particular context as well, right? And not to make grand sweeping claims, which can be not just overgeneralizations, but actually mischaracterizations of what the movement looks like or what the movements look like, right, in this particular historical moment. I think we need to think about this in terms of a movement with many dimensions and many locations. And this is true of a lot of movements, right? When you think back historically to, you know, movements that I've spent a lot of time working on, in addition to the LGBTQ movement, the global abolitionist movement, which emerges in the late 18th century and the 19th century, had many manifestations. It had manifestations, there was a very vibrant emergence of an abolitionist movement in Britain in the late 18th century. There was a really radical and more demonstrably anti-racial and egalitarian movement in the United States, which really picked up steam in the 1820s and 1830s. There was the Haitian Revolution, which was, in many respects, the largest rebellion of enslaved people in the world at that time, which led to the first independent Black Republic, the nation of Haiti. All of those were abolitionists, and all of that was abolitionism, but there were different manifestations of that. And likewise with, you know, if you just look at the U.S. the Black freedom struggle, the civil rights movement in the 20th century, right, you had different campaigns, you had different manifestations of what that looked like in northern cities, right, in places like Birmingham. We're not the same as Selma, we're not the same as Albany, Georgia, we're not the same as Greensboro, North Carolina. So I think it's important for us, whenever we think about movements, we have to think about the various locations and the various manifestations of them. And so I think when you think about the movement globally, I think there are lots of different ways that we can see it. There are places like the United States where there's been enormous progress made in a relatively, historically speaking, a relatively short period of time. But there are still enormous challenges and problems and violences and discriminations that exist right here in the United States, which if you think about the U.S. globally in relation to other countries would be seen, I think, by most people as a place that's made more progress than a lot of other places on the planet. But there are still problems here. There are different ways of seeing what the movements are doing and different areas of focus for movements in places like Ghana or Uganda or Kenya or places like the Czech Republic, places like Russia, places like Thailand or the Philippines, right? So there are different ways that the movements manifest themselves depending on where they are. And I think it's really important for us to be sensitive to that so that we're not making sweeping claims, again, that are overgeneralizations and mischaracterizations, but also imposing a sense of the global movement that is very much really about what we're doing in the global north or in the what we used to call the West or even in the United States. So I'm all for variation and context and nuance in that way. And it makes it hard to make like one claim about one moment and one movement.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that really speaks to what we've been hearing from the organizers who are working on the ground. In countries like Brazil or like Mexico, we see a huge distance between the laws that are being enacted, some of the most progressive laws in the world when it comes to protecting the LGBTQ community. But on the enforcement side, though, that's not really translating. Whereas in Kenya, for example, we see a blatant criminalization in terms of the law of the community, but there's still some very powerful organizing and representation happening. So I think you're absolutely right. It's kind of impossible to encapsulate everything that's going on and reduce it to a single moment. And speaking of variations and contextualizing trends, my next question is for Diego. Diego, this year, 2024, has been defined as not just an election year, but the election year. At least 64 countries are going to head to the ballots, representing a population of about half of the world. As we know, when it comes to social movements, the progress that we've made often also triggers the backlash. And I'm curious about your thoughts. How do we navigate this paradox of progress in 2024 when so many people are heading to the ballots?
So, you know, this is a very interesting time that we're in. As Tim mentioned, we're coming out of maybe the best 20 years for LGBTQ rights in the global north. And because of the globalized world we live in and the technology that we have that connects us, that is reaching other democracies and other places where this advocacy hasn't really been done, and where a lot of misconceptions, myths, and misunderstandings of LGBTQ people exist. And so when they see the progress that happens in the United States and Europe, where there have been those conversations and people have brought down busted a lot of these myths, that can trigger backlash in many of those places, including many democracies. And what is, I think, most scary of all is the backlash is trying to stop any advocacy from happening in their country, which from my research that I've done with Freedom House and other folks, where there is no advocacy, there is virtually no progress. So the crisis is that the progress that we have seen in the United States and Western Europe and in some parts of South America will be completely stopped in the global South, leaving generations of LGBTQ people with no progress and under the strictest and most harsh state persecution laws ever for LGBTQ people. And so that is a big paradox of seeing a place like Greece pass marriage equality this year, as opposed to a place like Ghana, where their parliament just passed the strictest anti-LGBTQ law that we have seen in Africa. It completely puts into danger any advocate out there with prison sentences from 3 to 5 years just for simply putting something on your social media. It also imprisons anyone involved with gender-affirming care. And so it's important for the backlash to understand that this work has to be done in the cultural context by folks who live there to understand what LGBTQ people's lives are in those places. And so, you know, there's a lot more that needs to be done for the global community in those other burgeoning democracies to be able to kind of get to where we are. So, you know, it's a precarious time. I will say at the same time, it's a time fraught with opportunities, because we have new technologies that allow people to reach others in ways that we haven't been able to do before. Something that I'm sure that Harry Hay, which founded the Managing Society in 1950 in the United States, the first LGBTQ or sustained LGBTQ rights organization, would have loved to have something like social media to be able to do advocacy. So it's both a time of great fear of the backlash, but also great opportunity. And just one notable thing that I want to say is in 2020, Ghana, an LGBTQ rights organization in Ghana, began work on opening an LGBTQ center in Accra. And in 2021, it was inaugurated with many European leaders coming and whatnot, but the backlash was so severe, it shut down almost instantly. And then now we see this huge rollback. So it's important for people who work in this space to understand like where their societies are, how to do the hard work of understanding and reaching people so that they can manage the backlash that comes. Because there's nothing worse than doing some progress that is not only rolled back, but the backsliding is so severe that you get to places even worse than before.
Yeah, and the problem with criminalizing advocacy is that it ends up affecting absolutely every other movement. And something that we heard directly from the other organizers and advocates that we've interviewed is kind of the need and energy to create this intersectional movement with the environmental justice movement, indigenous rights, labor. It's absolutely critical in order to advance the rights of LGBTQ people and also outweigh the anti-gender movement. But if you're criminalizing advocacy, where do you even start, right? And I think the other big thing that we're seeing is misinformation is a key strategy used by the anti-gender movement to hinder progress. And I'm just wondering, in both of your perspectives, how the LGBTQ movement can effectively counteract these narratives. What should a successful awareness raising or education campaign look like today?
One thing that I wanted to mention, building on something Diego just said, and also what you just said, Evie, that gets at this question a bit, is that I think sometimes it is absolutely true that this paradox of progress occurs whenever social movements are successful. This is actually a generalization that I think holds historical truth, which is and current truth, which is that, you know, when movements come together and people figure out how to have power and they push the institutions of power and the systems of oppression to move and change, and then they are successful at that. And whatever that looks like, that could be a particular policy issue, it could be rights extended to groups of people that have not historically had those rights, right? There are lots of things that can be symbolic, can be more, you know, more substantive. There are lots of ways we can think about success or wins. But one thing that we know is true is that that backlash is always going to come, either because or both because it's deeply rooted. Those were the forces that the movements were fighting against to begin with, right? If this were easy, they wouldn't have to fight so hard or in an ongoing way. And so the forces of reaction that create and fuel the backlash are already there. And then oftentimes the opposition is very creative in how it sort of moves, the best opposition, frankly, is opposition that can shapeshift, right, and can reinvent itself in various ways and find other ways to sort of oppose. But that backlash, what I call the paradox of progress, in the face of progress, the reaction against it, and Diego's done excellent work on this backlash globally, is something that activists and organizers know in their bones to be true. And that's why we need to listen to them, right, because they know what's going on, right? They understand the forces that are arrayed against them, and they have come up with the tactics and strategies to try to confront them. And in many cases, they've had clear signs of success. So they know what that looks like. And they're often best equipped to gird themselves for the coming backlash. So activists and organizers have to inform everything we do and everything we say about what we're talking about. So that's one thing. But the other thing I wanted to mention is that in some cases, these draconian laws that we're seeing passed in various jurisdictions, including here in the United States, all of the, you know, the hundreds of anti-LGBTQ laws, particularly targeting trans people, non-binary people, people of color, there are examples of this worldwide. Just take the Ghana law, right? This law in Ghana says, it's called the Human Sexual Rights and Ghana Family Values Bill. So just look at the name, like this is how they're framing this, right? It's a sort of sexual rights and then family values, right? Which are often sort of at odds with each other. But one of the things, and Diego is getting at this, one of the things this law does is it says that if you're convicted of being gay, right? If they can figure out you're gay, and we should say that in Ghana, gay sex has been criminalized for years, right? That's already the baseline they're starting from. So they're adding to this. So gay sex is already criminalized in Ghana, but this new bill says that if you're convicted of being gay, right, then you go to jail for up to 3 years. But they also say if you form or fund an LGBTQ organization, if you're found guilty of forming, developing an organization, or funding it, you go to jail for up to 5 years. So there's more penalty, jail time, for funding and forming an LGBT organization than there is for being gay or queer or LGBTQ yourselves. And then, additionally, there's a 10-year potential jail sentence for people who are doing any LGBTQ advocacy directed specifically at children, right? So you see in this bill, and there you could analyze any bill, right? But this bill in Ghana, right, both shows how the criminalization is expanding and extending to people who are funding, forming, and advocating, right, which could include people who are outside of our community, right? And also, if you read it that way, you can see that they are admitting that the movement is winning in Ghana, that the establishment of that organization and that site, location for organizing in Accra, was something that freaked them out. So this bill is an example of the backlash, but it is also an admission of the fact that they're on the defensive, so they have to go on the offense. Right. If the activists and organizers in Ghana and globally, their allies globally, had not been successful, this bill wouldn't exist. So I think there's a way in which we can read these draconian laws in both ways, right? Both as evidence of a backlash, but also as evidence of success, right? And that's what I think the activists and organizers again understand in their bones.
And just touching on the bit of misinformation that you mentioned, I think this is at the heart of it, because one of the things that people outside the US, especially in the global South, have started doing is saying that LGBTQ people identities are a Western invention, something that was created and is being brought into the country like an ideology. Whereas we know that LGBTQ people have been around since the beginning of recorded history. We know that there have been Roman emperors who have been gay and even trans illegalibus, which Tim and I talk about in our class. And but there is now these misinformation campaigns that this is something new infecting society. And so it's important for activists to dig into the histories of LGBTQ people and see if they can find something meaningful to combat those narratives. New narratives are being built all the time as well. In the United States, for example, we saw that this new generation is really liberated. Bi people are the biggest growing sector in self-identification in the United States. And as such, the new right-wing movement against LGBTQ people have tried to say that this is something that is being done to kids at school. And so you see new laws like the Florida Don't Say Gay bill that try to limit the conversations about LGBTQ people in schools with the pretext that this is something that's going to stop your kids from becoming gay. So this is misinformation built in to a legislative action. And so it's important also, especially in countries where social acceptance is already really low. And we're talking about places like Russia, 14%. And this is based on some amazing Pew Research data. Nigeria, 7%, that people understand where that baseline is before you start. Understand also what are the justifications that really good people tell themselves for not accepting, right? It's usually things they believe in that are not true, like, oh, this is something that can be changed, so I'm not going to support this because they should be trying to get themselves changed or fixed somehow. It can, and it runs the gamut of all kinds of myths. And so a lot of the advocacy work that needs to be done is to undo that. Of course, there are people who know that we're being LGBTQ is just a normal, this is part of the human diversity that we have, just like we have all kinds of heights, eye colors, etc. We have all kinds of sexualities as well and gender identities, but we are a convenient scapegoat for those people to claim power. And that's especially true in places that are clamping down on democracy. And we see that in Hungary, we see that in Russia, where even after passing a ban in the 2010s, now there is now a label of extremism for anyone doing LGBTQ rights there. So I think there is a lot of work to be done to undo those baselines. And that really opens up, one, it creates safe spaces for LGBTQ people to be at least not act violently on in their societies. And when people find safety, at least, I think that's always the first step, they can then start working on bigger projects. But second, you can call out the people that are using LGBTQ people as a scapegoat or as a way to get power as they try to dismantle democracies around the world. So those are two important things that and trends that we should be aware of in the movement. It's not always about deep religious beliefs, which it can be, and it is in many places of the world, but also just anti-democracy movements. We're one of the first people they come after.
Can I build on that, Evie? Can I? Because there's so much in there that's really rich and insightful that Diego's laid out. And you know, this conception, that this framework that Diego often uses of myths and misconceptions and misunderstandings, right? You know, I think in the framing of that, which I think is really smart, like lies a kind of strategic opportunity, right? That the myths are false narratives, right? Myths are things that aren't true, that take on cultural meaning or significance, and that sometimes are deeply rooted in the kind of, you know, the groundwater of our various cultures. And so the myths need to be busted, right? The myths need to be abolished. The false narratives need to be undone, and then new narratives need to take their place, right? So that's a storytelling conflict in some ways, right? So myths have to be abolished. Misconceptions, right, are when those myths have sort of gotten in you, and your perception or conception of another person or a group of people is influenced by that, right? And that's hard to do. That's hard. That's culture change work. That can't be done in a legal decision or one public policy. Like, that's culture change work, which is harder, but it's also in some ways more profound and powerful and potentially transformative and liberatory. And so those misconceptions is sort of saying, like, these people are pedophiles, right? That's one myth, right? Is that queer people are going to harm your children, right? That is a pervasive myth. It's ancient. It is not new. It reinvents itself all the time, but it's really, it is what it is and what it always has been. That myth leads to a misconception that compel parents to want to protect their children, right? The harms children, protect children, or save children is again an ancient and also very modern discourse. So changing that is hard, right? And so, I mean, how do we change that? I think we tell different stories, right? We challenge those master narratives, which are all myths, and they're false, they're untrue, they're lies, right? And we need to call that what it is and then come up with new narratives. But we also need to simply exist, which I know is harder in some parts of the world. That's why they're coming for us, right? It's why they want to put us away or get rid of us entirely. And so, I mean, that's the point of it, right? Because our very existence proves a certain kind of falsehood, right, of the myths themselves and the misconceptions. Misunderstandings for me is in some ways the lighter lift, because misunderstandings are both willful, right, sometimes rooted in those myths and based in those misconceptions, but sometimes misunderstandings are just sort of like, you know, bystanders could have absorbed things, right, in the culture, and they don't really believe it, but they don't have anything to counter it. And so if you are a neighbor or a classmate or a person in an organization or a workplace that is queer, and you show up, you exist, you do your work, you know, you don't cause any trouble, the fact of the matter is that over time will soak in, and it will be in some ways a kind of antidote or countervailing force. And so one of the things that you see in societies that have made significant progress in terms of the extension of rights, the changing of laws, the sort of expansion of freedom and equality for LGBTQ plus people globally, is that these are places usually that where queer people have been able to represent themselves publicly and privately in ways that are positive, that have really shifted the culture. And to continue to say, I mean, that's one thing that happened in the United States after the passage of marriage equality, right? There, when the fight for marriage equality in the United States happened, 70% of the culture was opposed to it, right? And 30% maybe, barely, was in favor. Now it's exactly the opposite. And the reason is because a whole bunch of queer people got married in the United States once that legal decision came down in 2015. And we didn't destroy marriage. We didn't molest your children or our children. And we didn't screw anything up. We showed the world that, like, love can exist in many forms, like genders and sexualities and heights and skin colors and all of these other wonderful human variations. And so once that is proven, right, we in our existence and living and loving the way we do and insisting on that, right, is the proof in the pudding.
Yeah, and I think precisely because of what you're talking about, the culture and narrative change initiatives are being leveraged by so many advocates and organizers across the globe taking advantage of social media, right? And I mean, I think we've talked about this before, but I believe that the stories we tell shape the world we live in. But yes, we do need to exist in order to shape and tell those stories. And back to your first point, it's about the not LGBTQ movement, but LGBTQ movements in the developing world. It's absolutely critical to recover and decolonize the movement in order to make sure that it's not seen as a Western imposition. And I think research can play a very big role in making sure that advocates have sort of the tools to win against the anti-gender movement. Going back to another thing that you mentioned previously, organizers and advocates know best, right? And yet something that we've been hearing across the board has also been that funding to fuel the movement is non-existent. And even when it is there, it's scarce, inflexible, short-term, and constrained to projects that are usually concocted by top-down strategies. And so these, especially reporting requirements, leave a ton of organizations out. I'm wondering to hear both of your thoughts about what specifically philanthropy and what funding can look like in order to make sure that we're actually advancing the priorities and voices of the organizers and advocates who know best.
So, you know, this, I think that this is an area that needs a lot of work. And I don't blame a lot of people from the Western countries of trying to focus on their own because their people are under attack. But I also, and this is something that the Global LGBTQ Human Rights Program at Harvard is trying to do, we have to realize just the extent that other LGBTQ folks around the world are living in. And I mean, complete oppression from day one, complete trauma for LGBTQ youth, the threat of state persecution, mob violence. And so I often do see people ready to give millions of dollars to the trans community here in the United States, and I know they need it, right? So I do understand that that's important. But I also, and this is something that I work with a lot of partners at Harvard, like Cornell Brooks and Deval Patrick, we need to think morally bigger too. If there are people also being left behind at that stage, we can also think with bigger global solidarity, especially because a lot of the progress here has sparked some backlash in those places. So even I would say we take some of that responsibility as well. And the global movement overall is very underfunded. There are some great foundations doing this work, and I really commend them. Astrea, Borealis, and some others. I also think that we need those work folks that work in philanthropy should also make a new movement, committed movement, to fund more international work and bring new dollars in from their networks to do this, to make a case about the crisis that exists. And, you know, foreign assistance programs, they're harder and harder to get to even in different places. So I do agree, a lot of people call this trust-based philanthropy, but just letting people do what they need with their money. I do believe in other ways of partnering with folks to make sure that they're effective, like what we do at HKS, which we bring folks from the highest needs areas of the world. We give them the best that we have in organizing and activism. And then we also challenge them to think about how they could be doing better work. But we don't tell them what to do. We don't tell them to report in any way. And so, you know, investing in programs like ours, which we supercharge, I would say, a lot of the work is a good way. But keeping a lot of the requirements and all the work that goes into just receiving enough funds to get started is a big issue. And so, I would say in my research, I did a big research project on the barriers that activists face. And what I got back was, number one, the biggest barrier was resources. These people were trying to do their work while being able to feed themselves. And a lot of the folks that I talked to were working part-time somewhere enough to be able to eat and then spending all of their other waking time doing their work. And so, you know, there isn't that ability to do the work full time unless the resources are there. Second, which is very important, was, of course, safety. So investing also, I think, in ways that technologically people can meet, diaspora communities can meet It's important. I think philanthropy can do a lot there in funding platforms or whatnot that make advocacy safer for folks. And so those are the major two. But I do think that there needs to be a lot more done in the international solidarity space for the global movement.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there are a couple of things that we need to acknowledge head on and say out loud as much as possible. One is what Diego just said, which is that, we have major challenges and a lot of work to do for sure. I think another thing that we need to, related to that, that we need to acknowledge is that there are huge inequities and asymmetries in terms of the where those resources are located, right? And who gets to take who gets the privilege and opportunity to take part in them and to enjoy them. And the reality is that the wealthiest foundations, whether they're small foundations or big foundations, family foundations like the Ford Foundation or the Gates Foundation or the Clinton Foundation, the Obama Foundation, I mean, all of those foundations are here in the United States, not just in the global North and the West, but like here in the US. And that's just true. And so we have to confront that. We also have to confront the fact that the most well-resourced in terms of money, LGBTQ organizations are also located in the global North, the West, and the US, and that there has to be some kind of redistribution that is a priority if the movement is going to be truly global and as liberatory as it can be for as many people as it can be. And so that's something, that redistribution of wealth, right, is something, and you see this in almost every dimension. You're talking about public health, you're talking about, anything, pick an issue, right? The redistribution of wealth is one of the solutions to the inequities and asymmetries. And so that is very much true of our movement as well. I think though, that we should be careful in two directions. One is I think we need to be careful to equate resources with money, right? And wealth, material wealth. And as important as it is to redistribute that, I think resources are much, much bigger than just dollars and money. And as important that is, I mean, Diego's program, the program here at the Carr Center is something, and that summit in particular is a perfect example of this, right? The word got out through the networks that were pre-existing across the globe and in the movement itself. Then social media helped to kind of lubricate that communication and that connection and then coalition building that then yielded over 1,000 people who applied in 2 weeks to come to the summit, which had never existed before, right? Which of course is an example of the kind of appetite and then the need and the demand for other kinds of resources, knowledge, right? Frameworks, tactical and strategic conversations, right? Communications training, right? All of these kinds of understanding global systems and system like the UN and transnational justice frameworks and these kinds of things, right? So folks need resources that are not just about money, right? This program didn't redistribute money to the organizations that the folks who came to the summit represent, but it gave an opportunity for leaders to come here on our dime, not their dime, right? And to gain and to gather and gain resources and to create their own resources and networks and coalitions and connections, which then can have ripple effects beyond this. So I think we need to think about resources in a really expansive way and think about what are all the resources? Are they social media technologies? Is it dollars? Is it knowledge and training programs and locations to be safe, to dream about a liberated world together, right? Without fear that the police are going to come knocking on the door and throw you in jail or torture you or kill you, right? Those are resources too. And so thinking expansively about resources so that we're not just always talking about money, which gets people stuck in for various reasons, is one thing. The other thing I think that is really important is the fact that a lot of times when the folks in the global North or West, whether it's philanthropic organizations or entities or universities or state departments or other kinds of entities, right, that are trying sincerely and earnestly and intentionally to do work in places in the global South, right, we have to understand that sometimes our presence there and our visible presence, which often comes with a lot of air in the room, right, is actually a problem, not a solution, even if we think were part of the solution. And so there are all of the, I mean, I remember I'm the board chair of another human rights organization that works on to combat the phenomenon of modern slavery and human trafficking. And we have had instances where there have been sort of a move from democracy to authoritarianism in certain countries around the globe, which have kicked us out of the country. Right? We can't do our work there anymore because we're seen as meddling or we're seen as doing something that's quite nefarious when in fact we're doing the work of abolition and liberation, right? Which is a threat to anyone who's an authoritarian, who's an anti-democratic force in the world. And so, you know, Diego mentioned all of these European leaders who came to Ghana to celebrate the opening of this LGBTQ center, right? That may not have helped. They may have thought that they were helping, but that actually may have accelerated or inspired the backlash. So I think we have to be really careful and humble and perhaps behind the scenes in the work that we do. We can redistribute wealth and create networks of connection and build coalitions and strengthen a global movement without being in the press all the time, out front, highly visible, taking up space. Right? I think there's a world where we can do that work in a more subtle way and perhaps in a more clandestine way, which could actually be, in some cases, more effective. I'm not saying that we should make ourselves invisible, but I'm saying we should be intentional about when we are highly represented and visible and vocal and when we're not. And all of that is part of the complexity, I think, but also the beauty of social movements that matter.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about kind of systems change, we often tend to analyze the systems, but we need to figure out where we fit into the system and assess our own role, what we're doing, how we're doing it, and how we're showing up. So I think we've covered so much. We've covered the opportunities, we've covered resources, narratives, strategies, opportunities, power. I want to move on to another pillar of any social movement, hope. What gives you hope in this moment?
Well, I think that we're reaching on, and I know Tim doesn't like the unprecedented word because almost everything is precedented, although lately that's been challenged. But we are in a real place of opportunity right now because of technology and because of we can really disrupt a lot of the ways that advocacy has been stifled around the world. And what I mean by this is, for example, a lot of people leave their countries when they're LGBTQ so they can live freely elsewhere. But we do have the technology nowadays to amplify those stories, right? So diaspora communities could become global movements, LGBTQ rights advocacy movements, away from the authoritarian hands trying to close them down. So, you know, we need to think of new ways of doing this. We have the technology. We're at a period of time where this can actually be happening. So what gives me hope is all the opportunity that exists to innovate on advocacy. And I think that we can, if we embrace that challenge, see incredible movement and progress in places where we thought none was possible and where there actually is zero registered organizations whatsoever, although there's always folks doing this work. So that's one. And two, I do see, and this is something that I say often when I'm talking to people on the subject, once people get serious about this, there is a lot of movement and fast. And there is one of the studies that we talk about often in the Queer Nation class at Harvard, that when people start interacting with other LGBTQ folks, or with LGBTQ folks in their societies, they undo a lot of those myths, misconceptions, etc. We actually don't know exactly why, but the studies have shown that interaction leads to people being more accepting. And so one of the important parts about this movement is queer people come in every part of society, high society, low society, etc., castes, all types. And it's one of the strengths of the movement as well, that when people come out and they interact, sometimes they call this the Republican son, not senator son effect, where a Republican senator can be totally against marriage equality, for example, their son comes out and all of a sudden they're for it. But think about that. Once things start to improve in a society, those people start interacting with others, and that changes hearts and minds. That in turn makes it easier for more people to come out, and they do an effect. So there's a snowball effect. There's an amplification effect. And all we need to get started is those initial pushes to get us through the threshold that keep things static. So for me, the hope is that once we push through those really hard times, actually the acceleration effect of this is seen very fast, and change can happen very quickly in one generation even. And I, one of the things that reminds me of that is when I was on the board of the Human Rights Campaign, somebody asked me, do you ever, and this was right after the UNASA UNTEL was repealed, do you ever think transgender people would ever be able to serve openly in the military? And I thought about that for a long time and how I felt about the United States in that moment. And I said, I don't think that's ever going to happen in my lifetime. It happened less than a decade after. And so and that's also one of the things that prompted me to really study this. At places where it seems like things are hopeless, actually, there you just need to get through that first threshold for this acceleration effect to happen, and things can change so fast. So that gives me hope as well.
You know, it's this question of hope haunts me. I spend a lot of time thinking about hope, searching for it in hard places. This is a time where that has become, for a variety of reasons that we all understand, I think, more challenging, to say the least. And there are days where, you know, I think I certainly fall into the depths of despair. And I said earlier this year to my students, I think you were both there, I think, when I said this, or some version of it, that I feel myself increasingly stuck at the intersection of helplessness and hopelessness. And that's just not a place that I will ever agree to live and or stay stuck. And when I think about this, you know, I'm of a certain age, I'm older than both of you. And I think a lot about my late mentor, Howard Zinn, the very famous people's historian. And he always said, when people asked him this question, or he used to write about hope, and he said, you know, we cannot give that up. We have to keep, so that's the thing that fires us up and fuels our work. And we have to keep focusing on it and trying to find it. And he always said that, you know, ordinary people gave him hope, young people gave him hope, and brave people gave him hope. And or maybe that's my interpretation or rubric for what I learned from him. But what he meant by that, I think, is that so often we are looking to or hoping that the powers that be, whether they're people from high society, whether they're wealthy folks, they're people who are well positioned politically or within any kind of social system, that we keep waiting for them to pass the laws or to give the ruling or to win an election or to redistribute their wealth or fund this project or what have you. So often we're looking up to those folks for the kind of the engines of change, when in fact the fuel for the engine of change is always with ordinary folk, because the ordinary folk understand what it means to be left out, what it means to be marginalized, what it means to be a misfit, what it means to be maligned and misunderstood, right? And in that experience, those lived experiences is the fuel of a different world, right? And that can give hope. And ordinary people have always banded together. Not always, right? Sometimes people just fall into the pit of despair, and that's what it is. But I think that, you know, when ordinary people have realized, looked around and said, you know what, if we come together, maybe it's just a small group of us, right? We come together to start something and set something in motion. We can do this because, and then we're close to the people, right? Ordinary folks are the vast majority of the world's population. And so ordinary people are there. Young people have always, 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 always fueled the future. And that's been true. That was true when I was a young person, right? And it's true for you too, right? When I look at both of you, right? I'm very hopeful when I think about a world that Evie and Diego are going to help to create, that I hope I'm still alive to, like, you know, help with and to live in. Right. But you all and in your generation, these rising generations that I have the enormous privilege and blessing to teach, right, give me hope all the time. Actually, you all are the reason I'm still able to get out of bed in the morning, frankly, because I get to spend time with you and hear from you and learn from you and continue to be inspired by the different ways that you're doing your work in the world and seeing how to do it. And so that inspires me. And then I think, you know, there's a smaller group of people, Right. Ordinary people are the vast majority of things. Young people are a significant part of the population. But then there's the brave people. Right. And queer people are brave, especially the queer people who live in places where being queer is illegal. Right. Those are the bravest people we have. Again, which is why we have to listen to them and take their lead. Right. And do what they're asking us to do or demanding us to do or not, maybe not yet asking because they don't have the capacity to connect in that way with the folks who have that those resources. So the brave folks come in smaller numbers, but in every time and space. And so those folks also give me hope. And the thing for me that keeps me going is that I still have the aspiration in my life and still some time to become one of those brave people. We all do. And so as long as we're still here, we still got some work to do, fine. And then I think for me, the ultimate thing that gives me hope is history, right? I take the long view. And when we think about that arc of the moral universe that Theodore Parker, the abolitionist, and then Martin Luther King, the great Black civil rights activist in the United States, said we have to bend towards justice, right? Like when I think about the long view of things, it's hard to fall into despair because in the long view, right, history is the ultimate judge of how we do our work and how we live in the world and what kind of world we create, right? And so our work is to do the work. History will judge us. So we have to do that work as best we can with whatever we have available to us.
Yeah, thank you both for sharing that. And, you know, I always ask about hope because it sounds so simple. But it's really the biggest driving force of change, right? And it's like, yes, there is so much hopelessness in reading the news and seeing the backlash. There is despair. But my biggest takeaway from this sort of mini-series on the LGBTQ movement worldwide is that there is so much hope. We find hope in innovation and strategy and especially in community. So I'd like to thank both of you for sharing your insight and spreading your hope with us.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for inviting us.
Yes, thank you, Evie, and just very thankful for us to be able to share our thoughts.
And to our listeners, don't forget to tune in to our other episodes on gender and international development. Thanks for tuning in.